Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Days after the Fed decided against cutting rates, new jobs figures suggest the U.S. economy is cooling, raising the prospect that the Fed might, after all, cut rates this year. A shareholder advisory firm recommends investors vote to oust outgoing Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun and two other board members off the company's board as the company issues $10 billion in debt. As Boeing struggles with its Starliner spacecraft, China has launched a spacecraft to land on the far side of the moon and return with samples. Embraer considers making bigger aircraft to compete against Boeing and Airbus, and even perhaps someday COMAC. Sierra Nevada lands a $13 billion contract to develop the Air Force's next-generation nuclear command and control planes, a job that historically has gone to Boeing. More earnings, including what Thales returns, tell us about European defense orders, and Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall makes history in being the first senior leader to fly aboard an AI-powered fighter, the legendary X-62A Vista jet. Joining us today, as they do every week, to discuss all this and more are our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Ablafia of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy in Washington, D.C. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Richard, welcome back after a grueling trip back from Korea. So we look forward to hearing any insights you might have on that front. Ron, start us off on the week, right? I mean, a couple of days after the Federal Reserve, passed on rate cuts, getting disappointing the market. We had jobs figures that are a little bit cooler than what people had expected. And so a little bit of optimism that actually rate cuts might be coming. But walk through how the group performed against the broader market.
Yeah, so I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head. I mean, kind of everything's been driven, and we've mentioned this before in the podcast, by the Fed, macroeconomic concerns and where interest rates are going to go. The 10-year yield fell 20 basis points to 4.5 from about 4.7 last week, and that was driven late in the week by the commentary you mentioned, the commentary by the Fed, and also where the jobs numbers came out. So that being said, on the week, it was volatile, but the S&P was flat. In our world, the commercial aerospace names did better than the defense names, not to be unexpected in a kind of a risk-on posture from investors if they're thinking that the Fed could potentially cut. Boeing shares were up about 3.5%. Embraer shares, same thing, were up about 3.5%. When you look at, as sort of bellwethers of defense, Lockheed was down 1.5%. Northrop was down about 3.5%. Raytheon was down about 1%. The real champ on the week was Howmet. It was up about 17.5%. They reported earnings this week, and we can talk through that a bit. But really, it's kind of all eyes on the Fed.
Indeed, it is. But as you said, right, there's such a multiplicity of factors that could be that are going to happen just over the next couple of months, much less over the course of the entire year, right? So we'll see on how all of this goes. Sash, why don't you lead us through the group and how it performed this week in Europe, especially against the broader market, at a increasingly critical time. And I'm going to ask you kind of a follow-up question on Emmanuel Macron's continuing comments and what sort of impact they're having on the European ecosystem, especially in the wake of his extraordinary economist interview. I mean, I said this on Friday's show. I'm probably going to talk about this many more times. People should really read it because this is a strategic mind at work saying a lot of the right things, including the importance of British cooperation in the future of European security, which I think also is welcome. But start us off with that broader trend information.
Yeah, okay. So look, European markets were, plus or minus 1% this week, trading in a very, very tight band overall. But they've been up on the year. The UK market's up 6% on the year. France up 5%. Germany up 7%. I mean, they're very, very tightly linked. I've got to say, I think the European aerospace and defense stocks are almost totally unlinked from their domestic markets. They certainly have been this year. And this week, it was very much a, it's not so much a matter of risk on, risk off, but you know, many of our listeners will remember the situation we had both in the summer of 2022 and then in the summer of 2023. You'd have a day or a couple of days when Ukraine seemed to be doing well in the war with Russia. And if Ukraine was doing well, defense stocks would do badly. The thought process being, oh, they're going to win and then there's going to be no more demand for defense. And then if Russia did well, then defense stocks would do well. The argument being, if they do well, we're going to have to put more defense equipment into Ukraine. The war's going to go on longer. Europe will rearm, blah, blah, blah. Well, this was definitely one of those latter weeks. Ukraine is not doing well in the war. The Russians have rearmed and, you know, redeployed their armies very, very successfully at the moment. And Ukraine is losing territory at a, you know, an uncomfortable rate at the moment. There's a lot of pressure being put on a small town called Chasny Yar. I mean, one of the many tragedies of this war is that we get to learn about towns in Ukraine that we'd really never, ever thought we'd learn about, because thousands, if not tens of thousands, of young men and women die there in this war. And at the moment, the Russian focus is on Chasny Yar. But what does this do to European defense stocks? They're up. And they're up because there is a recognition that even after the US $61 billion spending built up, you know, the majority of which, or a majority of which, benefits Ukraine, Europe is going to have to spend more and more, both to try to make sure that Ukraine doesn't lose. And that's the situation we're at, trying to stop them losing. And then be actually to rearm so that Europe can deter Russia from taking this any further. And there's very little confidence that either of those are going to happen quickly enough and at enough pace. But what does this mean? You know, if you look at European defense stocks this year, I mean, European defense stocks were up 2.5% this week, several flat, absolutely flat. BAE Systems up 3%, Chemring up 6%, Kongsberg up 6%, Kinetic up 4%, Rheinmetall up 5%. You know, these are really strong performances by some of European, and particularly by some of the UK defense stocks. And by contrast, I'm struggling to find a civil aerospace stock that was up very much at all. Probably the best was MTU, which was up a couple of points. We can talk about that later.
I want to, you know, and you know, in terms of unfortunately Ukraine losing ground, right? It's about, depending on the estimates you read, about 600 square kilometers, which is a real tragedy considering how hard fought those gains have been. I mean, there's been a lot of blood and treasure that's gone into every square kilometer, every square foot in some cases. And just to see it sort of being given back at the hands of just, you know, Russian, overwhelming Russian fire as opposed to savvy is just very, very distressing. And so, yes, the arms package is absolutely critical. But the question is, how quickly does it get into the hands of people who need it? Because unfortunately, because of that 8-month delay, Ukraine lost the very thing that they couldn't afford to lose, which are troops. I'll get off my soapbox. Let me take you to, and Richard, thanks for your patience on this. How do Emmanuel Macron's comments shape things, right? Last week, we had him speak to the Sorbonne in an almost 2-hour speech that was very thoughtful. His interview in The Economist, also very powerful, and notes, I think, what's reality. The United States increasingly is going to be focused in the Indo-Pacific. We in Europe have to do more. We cannot hitch our wagon exclusively to America because, as he notes, you know, things can get bad quickly. You know, and also, by the way, his point about putting boots on the ground in Europe may be a necessity. Let's think about that before, God forbid, the Russians break through, you know, because the biggest catastrophe is to have Ukraine overrun if we've put a marker in the sand, you know, and he's been criticized for that. But I think it's the right idea. How do his statements change any vectors in Europe, including his point that Britain is absolutely integral to this, and noting the importance of Lancaster House? And indeed, he's going to be going over to the UK to meet Rishi Sunak and talk about this. Well, walk us through the defense dynamic and what people should be bearing in mind in a top-line fashion when arguably one of the most strategic minds in Europe, who happens to be the president of one of the most important countries in the EU, is making this point.
I'd correct that. EU, in the EU, all countries are equal. Yes, there are countries that are bigger, but in terms of, you know, votes at the EU, one country, one vote. And this is part of that. You know, it's part. Europe is in many respects a problem of herding cats. So right. The fact that Emmanuel Macron is saying what you and I believe to be 100% spot on and really incredibly well argued and carefully crafted has distressingly less cut through in European capitals than you might think. Either they say, well, yeah, we knew that anyway, so you know, there's nothing new, or there is a, you know, there is always a mistrust of individual European nations, but particularly European nations that are large, standing up and sort of trying to change things and trying to change the status quo. So, you know, the good news this week is Denmark just increased its defense budget a whole load. They didn't do that with anything to do with Emmanuel Macron. They did that because they came to their own conclusions that they were poorly equipped and poorly prepared for what they've seen in terms of the rise of Russian power and Russian aggression. I, you know, as a Brit, I'm delighted that President Macron is still talking about Lancaster House. I think as Brits, we have been very bad at following up on the Anglo-French relationship. Ultimately, there is a problem that the UK is outside the EU, and sometimes the EU wants to do things in defence. And the continued friction between the EU and NATO is not something that's easy to work around. But so, you know, Emmanuel Macron's comments are incredibly welcome there. But, you know, no one European politician saying, frankly, anything has much of an effect on the day. It's a steady drip, but it's then the spread of those drips, to use a plumbing analogy, that that really starts to make a difference in Europe. So it's as other European nations make their own minds up about where they are, right. And you know whether they do that because Emmanuel Macron spoken or not. Generally, it's despite that, but that's actually what's changing the tone in Europe, and that's why European defense budgets are going up so fast.
I would say yes, it is one nation, one vote. But the French do have a gravity and have been one of the key architects of the entire European project since its very outset. And so yeah, generally, but the French president and the machinery gets moving, it has a tendency of highlighting issues to focus on. And one of the things he made clear is this isn't a EU versus NATO issue, which some people very simplistically try to make that case. It's to be a better partner in NATO, we have to get our crap together as Europeans, which we still haven't, which I think is spot on.
Yeah, no. As Europeans, I completely agree with. The problem is that the EU is a separate institution, which in some cases has either a quasi-military or a pretense to a military capability that might cause friction with NATO.
Richard, you've been very patient and have been very shy in expressing your views about Boeing's leadership. And we're among the first, we discussed this on the program, to sort of criticize the notion that the outgoing Boeing CEO, Dave Calhoun, and indeed other board members should actually stay on the board, which is the company has suggested in its paperwork. Glass Lewis, a shareholder advisory firm, is telling investors that this is actually not a good idea and that Calhoun and two others should go. We have talked about the board, you know, very accomplished people, very smart people, I'm sure very well-intentioned people, right? Nobody gets up every morning saying, dear God, I want to screw this up and help me. But alas, here we sit. As Gary Larson would say, you know, without opposable thumbs, right? At some point, you've got to sort of change the dynamic. What's your sense and the importance of actually making substantive changes on the company's board?
Well, I'm going to focus on the positive, right? I mean, the fact that Glass Lewis came out and said this, well, it brings to mind the possibility that shareholders do the right thing. And if not clear the board, because I think there might be one or two people worth keeping, then at least get rid of the really, really, really bad actors here. They have a lot to answer for. Pure and simple. I mean, the fact that Dave Calhoun is still in any way affiliated with the aerospace industry, let alone Boeing, is just a complete head scratcher. And the people who somehow protected him or kept him in power, they have a lot to answer for. So the possibility of a bunch of people going and replaced by qualified folks who really care about the industry, I frankly think is quite exciting. We all want Boeing back on the road to health and maybe even industry leadership. And these are the kind of moves that are absolutely essential to making that happen.
And I should point out the other two are Akhil Johri and David Joyce, who I should have mentioned at the top. Ron, how important is it when, I mean, right, Glass Lewis is a prominent shareholder advisory firm. How important is it to changing shareholder sentiment? And then once a company like this moves, do others follow in their recommendation? And in general, what are investors telling you? I mean, I'm sorry, but among the people on this call, you guys directly know people who control what, like a quarter or more the shares, or if not the vast majority of institutional shares that are being held. What's the sense you're getting about, step one was acknowledging you have a problem, and so you're making some leadership changes because of it. You're saying you're looking for a new CEO, but you're also saying that some of the people who've been responsible for some of the problems, I mean, Dave Calhoun has been on the board since 2009, if memory serves correctly. How does this play out as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, so to your first question, what am I hearing from investors? I think investors would like to see the CEO level change quicker. They don't want to wait till the end of the year. They just see that just as disruptive, that the sooner you can get a new CEO in and presumably their team, the better. So that's a common theme from investors. I think investors thought it was, unprofessional and surprising on the earnings call when Dave Calhoun came out and supported, his lead candidate for it. They were not, how can I say, that didn't go over very well. I guess this is the best way to say it. I think that's where they are. Investors want to change. The most common question we've been getting is, who is it? And, I think everybody's trying to place a bet on that. And, we'll see. My sense is that it actually hasn't moved that quickly. So, this is something that, probably won't happen for, maybe it is before the end of the year, but, it's not going to happen next week, famous last words, but I mean, it just sort of seems that way. And I agree with all of Richard's comments. I mean, to change the course of the company, a lot has to happen. And as we've discussed, I mean, this didn't happen overnight. Part of fixing Boeing is not just the nuts and bolts on the production line, pardon the pun, but it's changing the culture. And that has to come from the top. And that's going to take time. And then this leadership team also has to lead the company through the development of a new aircraft. And as we all know, that's tricky, and they have to choose the right thing. And so there's a part of this that has to be, I think, talented leadership team, and that part of this has to be a leadership team that genuinely cares about the company and the industry and is willing to, go in for the fight.
Talking about leadership, and we'll talk about this later in the program, right? The Secretary of the Air Force, at a time when the Air Force has to have a greater reliance on artificial intelligence, put some real skin in the game by being the first senior leader to climb on a jet that's AI driven and have it go through dogfights and maneuvers and, to demonstrate to the force, hey, look, I put my life on the line and I trust this capability. You should trust this capability too. That's what leadership is, right? Whether it's stuff that C.Q. Brown was doing in the Air Force or Dave Alvin or, Jim McConville was instrumental in helping change Army culture, or a Dave Berger or whoever, like sort of prominent leaders. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about leadership. It's about people and it's about the tone they set. Right. And I find it fascinating that message is often lost. You know, let's look at GE, right? Larry Culp is doing incredible things at GE. And guess what? The workforce is responding overwhelmingly to it. Sash, anything you want to add to this before we go to Boeing debt and maybe some other challenges and then Embraer and the like, but take a last bite at this leadership.
Yeah, honestly, I've got nothing to add to Ron and Richard here.
Ron, why don't we go back to you and talk a little bit about some of the specifics and how Embraer might end up putting some pressure on the company, right? I mean, you've long said you were the very first person that when we saw the KC-390 for the first time, you know, we were talking about all the things that were really incredible about the aircraft. And you said, you know what the most incredible thing is? It's the same diameter as a 767, right? And that was no accident. And now the company is saying, or at least suggesting through news reports, that it wants to move up the value chain, right? There's an overwhelming demand. People are waiting for a long period of time. So you could argue, you know, Boeing has its shoelaces tied together. Airbus can't deliver airplanes enough. So if you're sitting there in San Jose dos Campos, you're going to go, pretty good idea. Let me maybe get in this market as I've hit the ball out of the park with every product I've had. Talk to us about the $10 billion Boeing debt issue. And then Embraer and how that potentially changes the competitive dynamic, right? How much money would be required? What kind of partner they would have on this? Because at the end of the day, it's a company that's going to go up the food chain. The question is, how quickly does it go up the food chain? And at what point does it disrupt the competitive dynamic? And again, I'm one of the people who thinks that eventually COMAC is going to figure this out, right? Anyway, take it away.
Yeah, so two distinct topics here. So just quickly, On Boeing, you know, Boeing did a $10 billion debt raise this week. Some investors think it was enough. Some don't, actually. They have about $12 billion in maturities coming due over the next 2 years. And then they also have to finance Spirit if and when that actually closes. And then finally, they're going to, you know, we'll see how much cash they actually do generate this year. We, in our forecast, have them just breaking even. Some people think they might earn a little bit. Boeing has come out and said they could earn low single digit free cash flow. We'll see. It's sort of an open question right now. Interestingly enough, on their earnings call, Howmet said that they're planning for Boeing to be at an average of 20 737 max deliveries per month for the year. That's what they're planning to. So, I mean, that's, you know, if that actually is how it plays out, then, you know, Boeing's cash flow this year might be more challenging than people think. So anyway, that's the debt raise. And Boeing now has a lot of debt, $60 billion. It's a lot of debt. Now, off to Embraer. So there was a press report in the Wall Street Journal saying that, you know, Embraer is considering doing this. And I think there's a couple things you have to think about with this. And to your point on the KC-390, I don't think anybody doubts Embraer's technical prowess to pull this off. Could Embraer build a true narrow body class airplane? So what I mean by that, call it, you know, nominally, call it a 200 seat airplane, plus or minus 20 seats, 30 seats, something like that. Could they do that? Absolutely. Yeah, they could do it tomorrow. I have no doubt that they can technically do it. So it's not a technical challenge for them. The challenge for them are kind of the other factors. So one, you know, how are you going to pay for it? Even for them, who, meaning, you know, Embraer, who did 15 platforms over 20 years, very experienced doing this sort of thing, this is not a cheap investment. I mean, you're talking probably $5 billion for Embraer, something like that. You know, maybe a little more, maybe a little less. And it's a company that has a market cap of maybe $5 or $6 billion. So it's a significant investment for them. One, so there's risk there. They're on kind of a shorter leash, meaning no matter how much Brazil wants to support Embraer, they'll never get the same support that Boeing or Airbus would get from their you know, respective, you know, governments, right? So, you know, Airbus gets plenty of support from EU Inc. And, you know, Boeing gets plenty of support from the US. Embraer, I think you could argue, gets some support from Brazil, but not a ton. So they're always very, very careful, deliberate, and thoughtful about how they're going to do this. And the reality is, and we all know on this call, I mean, you can make the great airplane, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to come and buy it. So in terms of market access, how you're going to finance it, are you going to, you know, you're going to need at least some sort of tacit support from, you know, the trade representatives in different parts of the world. I mean, you saw what, you know, Boeing tried to do to the C series, right, with the tariffs from Canada. So you need some, on some level, some sort of support from trade representatives. So there's more here than just the can they do the plane. And so, you know, is this a done deal? Absolutely not. Is it something that they're considering? Yeah. You know, like any good company, you gotta look at your options. And, you know, for all the reasons you suggested, this is an interesting option, but it's, you know, in some ways, sadly, it's just more complicated than who can build a good plane.
Let's go in reverse order. Richard, what's your sense on this? And by the way, we should apply the Calhoun rule, right? It's actually a 50, you know, multiply that by 10 is what it's really going to cost to develop a new aircraft. That was just a joke, apparently.
Yeah,
quite as funny as I did. I thought one of you would bite on this, but anyway,
I'll be happy to help you. Yeah, no, I mean, the Calhoun rule is pretty much anything Calhoun says, you should do the exact opposite and indeed ignore it completely. So yeah, I think somewhere in the 5 to 10 range, depending upon what, depending upon how many members, and of course what new technologies embodies. But you know, just to echo Ron, my God, you know, this is, you know, the only company left with both the aspiration and the capability and just, you know, the deep respect of everybody. And of course, every leasor and lessor and financier and most of all airlines in the world wants a new player to fill the vacuum that, you know, Boeing leadership has created. Not a lot of believers out there in China. We can talk about that endlessly. You know, I think the sort of meta issue here too is that, don't forget, Embraer is a defense company. And also, don't forget, some of the potential partners to help create a jetliner are defense customers. And they're looking for basically new sources of weaponry, new suppliers. Russia has gone away. So if you're India, you know, what do you do? Concerns about Europe, concerns about the U.S. as suppliers. You don't want to be too reliant. Embraer is that classic third-party weapons provider. So in other words, there's the very real possibility that Embraer grows its role in these non-aligned markets or semi-aligned, India, UAE, Qatar, and Saudi, you know, places that are cash rich, non-aligned, interested in having and cultivating new weapons producers. And also, you know, frankly, they've got big aerospace industry aspirations in some cases, Vision 2030 in Saudi Arabia, everything to do in India, you know. Right. So there's so much potential here, I think, to make something happen. Having said that, we're talking about a bunch of stuff that has to align that, you know, makes, oh my God, you know, Boeing basically just has to get new leadership, flip a switch, and bring in, you know, equity, debt, whatever it needs, or just, you know, turn on the, get its act together in terms of delivering jets, turn on the great cash flow machine. They'll be fine. It doesn't take much to do a new jet. Airbus, of course, anytime it wants. Embraer, oh boy, they've really got to put together a giant coalition. And that's what keeps me from saying this is a total slam dunk.
So is this you know, given how quickly the company has shown it can develop new products, once they make the decision, is it 5 years? Is that a reasonable span before we could sort of see an Embraer, you know, 2 series or whatever they're going to call it as they climb up the numbers game? And then is an L3, for example, you know, one of the companies that would be involved in this, right? I mean, L3 is their partner, L3Harris, for the 390 in the United States after it went through various permutations and Boeing was in it, and then Boeing ended up screwing them, so that didn't work out.
Well, U.S. defense primes aren't in the business of taking commercial risk. None of them, really. I mean, the most that can be hoped for, you know, aside from a, you know, strategic partner like Saudi or India or, you know, UAE, is a company like RTX or GE. And maybe a right. First-tier aerostructures company. But for the most part, the idea of a U.S. defense company getting involved, except on the margins as a sort of, you know, special mission integrator or what have you, I just don't think it's realistic, unfortunately.
And for people who are not paying attention, right, B is, you know, the B in BRICS is Brazil at the end of the day, right, which does give it some non-aligned heft in some places around the world. Sash, your sense on the competitive dynamic and how it changes anything, yeah. Right, because it's, you know, all it is they're interested, says the journal, It's just that there are clearly a lot of steps between here and here and there, even if I think those steps might move a little more quickly in some respects, because it is a premier company to work with, right? I mean, nobody has any negative thing to say about working with Embraer as a general rule. Go ahead, take it away.
Yeah, okay. I'll just start with Boeing and the Boeing debt issue first of all, because actually I thought that sent some really interesting signals. Number one, look at the rate that Boeing is paying. Now, this is for debt extending out as far as 40 years. So it's the equivalent of a really long-term mortgage, but it's a fixed rate mortgage. And Boeing is paying between 6.3% and 7%. So the cost of refinancing is going to cost them several hundred millions of dollars annually in extra interest costs, because they're replacing much cheaper short-term debt. Second point on the debt, the maturities are very, very, generally very, very long-term. They're out, typically it's 10 years, 10 years, 30 years and 40 years. There's some short-term stuff. What does that mean? That means that Boeing thinks it's got bigger requirements for any cash flow it generates in the meantime, rather than just paying down extraneous debt. It's trying to free up its cash flow. And I'll bet be that they realize that they've got to, free up some cash flow so they can spend it on new developments. But overall, this doesn't suggest to us that Boeing can go out and afford to pay a great deal of money on either dividends or stock purchases anytime this decade, or frankly, next decade, not unless the company's financial situation changes dramatically. And there's no signs of that at the moment. Now, in terms of, Embraer and the next generation jetliner, I think Ron's point, it's absolutely spot on. It's a fantastic company. The company is capable of doing this, but it doesn't have the heft. And heft is a function of just balance sheet size, but it's also a function of the balance sheet of your sponsor government. And Brazil just isn't big enough, whether it's in the BRICS or not. It's going to need partners from other countries and who represents those other countries to help them. And I mean, we were talking about this all during this week. I mean, I would say of the relatively non-aligned countries, i.e. countries that are not so deep into the Airbus system or the Boeing system that they can't get out, paradoxically, Italy and Leonardo is one that springs to mind. Because Italy is certainly supportive of its aerospace industry and defense industry, very, very much so. They're partners to both Airbus and Boeing, but they're not so deep in that they couldn't come up with couldn't join a new program if they wanted to. They would be my immediate preference, if we're starting to pick teams. And it's worth pointing out that Leonardo and Embraer collaborated very, very successfully on the AMX fighter program. Admittedly, that's a couple of decades back, but that was an example of the fact that they could get down to it. Their engineers are clearly culturally compatible. That matters. So if the Italian government, wanted to get involved in a program like this, I think this would be a very, very, very attractive combination, because it would give a country with the right level of industrial support and the right level of technological support.
Ron, I want to come back to you because you've got your hand up, and maybe you can then also help us start the brief discussion on Sierra Nevada and the importance of that win. I mean, I know that a meaty portion of this program, we have one more Boeing question to address, but I mean, Boeing was the company that was, was dropped from the competition late last year, and the contract for $13 billion for these aircraft eventually went to Sierra Nevada. But finish up on the Boeing debt and Embraer dynamic, and before we move on to Sierra Nevada.
Yeah, just an interesting little thing to think about that we calculated. If you look at Boeing's interest expense with all this new debt, the amount they're going to pay, they could buy an Embraer every other year just with the interest expense. So we thought that was just sort of interesting, right? Right.
That is interesting.
So, yeah, that's all. That was my little addition.
Okay. So now let's bridge this into a company that has managed to go from strength to strength to strength, very humble beginnings. The Osmonds deserve an enormous amount of credit for having taken this company that was kind of a bomb rack company right to a space company, a company that has a just a penchant for being able to deliver. And, you know, I mean, this is really a breakthrough order. How important is this? And what vector does it put the company into? Because what I think it's interesting is, was the latest sort of small, privately held, or smaller than the giants, right? The both CCA competitors are privately held, General Atomics and Anduril, and now you have a privately held Sierra Nevada that is doing this. Walk us through the impact and the importance of this order, and Richard, then get your sense as well.
Yeah, the thing I would highlight on this is why did they win, and kind of one of the factors that has come up that's very important is, you know, data rights and intellectual property. And in my sense is that, you know, the Air Force, when you look at the sustainment of this system, they didn't want to be what they think is unfairly treated for data rights and IP that they need for sustainment. And, you know, I honestly, on this one, I kind of side with the Air Force. You pay for the development of it. Why wouldn't you have the IP? It's sort of that's how the game's played. And my sense is a big deciding factor here was that, you know, Sierra Nevada said, yeah, sure, yeah, you know, it's your IP. And Boeing didn't like that. When you look at the press reports that happened back in I think it was December that suggested that Boeing dropped out of the competition. Boeing was quoted for saying, you know, hey, you know, you don't want to, you know, do contracts that aren't, you know, in the best interest of the company, and we're not going to do, you know, firm fixed price contracts anymore. And what's interesting in this one, the EMD phase, you know, the development phase is not firm fixed price, it's cost plus.
Right.
Yes. So, you know, the level of risk that, you know, Sierra would be taking on this, at least on the development piece, is not so bad, right? And it wouldn't be for Boeing. And this kind of gets to, and I think this is my biggest takeaway, and I've heard this in many of the conversations I've had across the services, that the services are getting more sensitive about data rights, IP, and sustainment. And I think that really came to a peak with the F-35 and F-35 sustainment, and I would call it the kerfuffles back and forth with the DoD and Lockheed over, you know, who owns what and so on and so forth. And my sense is that this could be a deciding factor for, you know, something even, you know, even as big as NGAD, right? How data rights are going to be handled.
And would point out that in the future long-range assault aircraft, right, there was a difference in the approach. Bell, who obviously sponsors this program, said, the customer wants the data, you can have the data. And the other team was somewhat, you know, was saying, hey, look, we're going to reduce the price and everything else, but we're going to retain, you know, it's our data. And you're absolutely right. The customer is going back to where they historically would be. We own really all of it, and we can service it. We can give it to somebody else to service. You can keep servicing it. We may need other hands that are involved in it. We don't necessarily need a toll keeper at every point, you know, complicating things for us. Richard, your sense, and Sash, if you have anything to add, and I really want to go and touch base a little bit and a little deeper on what the Talos returns tell us about sort of the European arc. If there's anything else to add, even though I think we had a pretty good discussion about that higher up. But go ahead, Richard, since you've been following Sierra Nevada pretty closely for a long period of time.
Yeah, very impressive company. So congratulations to them. Having said that, you know, they mostly do small aircraft, you know, Super Tucanos, King Airs, what have you. This is a different, very different beast. So there's some risk here. Ron is absolutely right, of course, about the cost plus nature of the contract being distinct from the stuff that, you know, Boeing might walk away from, given their rather horrible track record of losing gobs of cash on fixed price contracts recently, the past decade or so. But, you know, clearly, given the absence of, you know, total proprietary control over the aftermarket data rights and all that, I'm sure there were other forms of commercial pressure that Boeing decided to walk away from. You know, see also the E-7 wedge-tail contract negotiations with the Air Force that clearly have stumbled badly because Boeing just doesn't want to be aggressive at this point. And, you know, I understand completely, you know, God knows leadership at Boeing Defense has gotten better over the past couple of years with Ted Colbert, and it's a lot more disciplined. But nevertheless, that's going to have an impact on how they comport themselves with contracts like these. And, you know, obviously, yes, the next thing to look for is NGAD. I still, you know, it's talk about a very difficult choice of the Air Force. You either rely on Boeing, and God knows that's not very promising, or you give the complete franchise for all fifth and sixth generation combat aircraft to Lockheed Martin, which tends to be complacent at the best of times. So devil, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. I guess ultimately they'll probably decide on Lockheed Martin. But that also reflects, I think, on Boeing's Boeing's increasing focus on profitability and risk avoidance on defense contracts.
On the other hand, right, I mean, Ted's point, at a time when a lot of folks thought, and I think we thought, that when they went to two aircraft, they, you know, were, that it was Lockheed and Northrop. And it turns out, you know, Boeing's still in it. And Ted always points out, hey, don't count us out. We know how important this is. We know how important it is to the customer. And there are some people, you know, on the customer side of things. Now, it could be a way to pressure Lockheed. But certainly nobody at Lockheed is looking at this as a done deal. And certainly, you know, there are some who say, hey, you know, we don't want a supercharged F-35 on steroids. What Boeing is offering is different. It's interesting. It's not the same old thing. We'll see at the end of the day. Hopefully the decision that's made is going to be the correct one. And it's, you know, kind of right around the corner, guys, right? I mean, this is not a distant award, given how fast the Air Force wants to move on everything from CCA to right. And none of the companies made it through the CCA cut. Sash, real quick, you know, give us your sense insofar as you want to comment on that, or we could hop directly to, you know, digging a little bit more deeply into some of these earnings and what they tell us. And Ron, want to get your sense on how Met and the resolution of the lawsuit, you know, I mean, just how generally the company performed a little bit more deeply, if there's insight, and then the resolution of the lawsuit with Lockheed Martin. Go ahead, Sash.
Yeah, look, I'm going to hop straight to the Thales Q1 revenues and orders announcement, because it was really good. It was really strong. And Thales and Dassault, the two big French defense stocks, have been they've been the real laggards in the European defense sector. We talked about this in the past. I mean, there's sometimes been a feeling that France and French defense companies have not been seen as being direct beneficiaries of the war in Ukraine. They haven't been that good at exporting into Eastern Europe. You know, things haven't been going that well for them. So, you know, of the big European defense stocks, they've definitely been the laggards in the last 2 years. But, you know, first quarter, book-to-bill in the defense business is 1.4 times. That's as good as Saab. That's as good as Rheinmetall. And those are the two companies that absolutely lead in terms of early cycle defense exposure. And it was really interesting just where all these orders are coming from. Yeah, there's some equipment for the third batch of the Indonesian Rafale aircraft. Because every time Dassault sells a Rafale, about a quarter of the value goes to Thales in terms of radars, electronic warfare equipment, and so forth. But there's also a huge air defense system for an unnamed Middle Eastern nation. Our view is, if you, particularly as a European company, if you can make air defense radars at the moment, you will sell them. So don't even bother to wait for the order. Build the radars, they will come. And we're really seeing that happen at the moment. It's an incredibly hot market for radar builders in Europe. And then air defense missiles. Europe doesn't have enough air defense missiles. I'm very irritated that Thales still refers to them as effectors. That was one of the most poisonous terms used. I think it was forced on them really by the ESG movement. They're missiles, you know. They are fired at aircraft and vehicles and stuff, but, you know, they're not effectors. But Thales has got a huge value. Every Aster missile, over a third of a million euros, is just the seeker head and the fuses, which Thales makes. And France and Italy are starting to rearm. UK is starting to buy or to refurbish Aster missiles, and the Ukrainians are firing them off. You know, they're very much held back as the strategic asset along with the Patriots at the moment. So it was a very, very broad base of, I think, strategically significant orders that they got in the first quarter. And our feeling is, you know, Thales's revenues are going to go up into well into double digits and stay there. And the only puzzle, frankly, is that the company isn't talking about it yet. I think that they are trying to be cute. They're trying to say, oh, you know, they've got a capital markets day at the end of the year. They want to, quote unquote, surprise us with an increase in their medium-term guidance. Well, you know, Thales management, that's 6 months away. You cannot sit on news like this for that long. Your business is clearly performing very well. You're finally seeing the defense upturn. And this is going to be, you know, the first quarter sales and orders numbers were absolutely clear evidence of that. And, you know, they should be raising their guidance now. One small point about MTU Aero Engines. The MTU numbers were fine, but no more than that. And what I thought was particularly interesting about MTU was just there was a note of irritation and despair about the fact that although they're a big partner on the Pratt & Whitney Geared turbofan engine, which has got this big recall going on at the moment, MTU don't seem to get any more information than the rest of us. They really are being kept in the dark, in the dark like mushrooms. And that seems to me to be a pretty poor way to treat a major partner on a program like this. But it may just be, you know, may highlight the degree to which Pratt is still quite under lot of pressure on the gear turbofan. And they literally, you know, they're not thinking about their partners at the moment. They're just thinking about how to deal with each customer and individual.
And it's interesting how fortunes change, because if we went back a year or two ago, a lot of questions about, you know, the strategy that Patrice Caine was implementing, and, you know, this sense that he's spending too much money on AI companies and IT companies and the like. And it seems to be that some of these elements are actually kind of coming together and helping the company at a time like this. And it's base business really playing a critical role in it. We've got a short amount of time. We're going to go a little bit of a lightning round. Ron, do you want to talk really quickly about how Met earnings in a little greater detail, and then the resolution of the Lockheed Martin suit, which we haven't discussed, even if it did happen, I think a week or two ago, if I'm not mistaken. Take it away.
Yeah, so quickly on the resolution with Lockheed Martin, they settled. I mean, just the posturing from the helmet side, they seem happy. Part of the deal was they can't really talk about it. So, I mean, what the deal, the details are, we don't know. They tend to be reasonably vocal. And if they were unhappy about it, they would probably have, you know, let us know. On the quarter itself, and this shouldn't surprise anybody, you know, demand for jet engine maintenance, repair, overhaul, spare parts, is just through the roof. I mean, it's really, really remarkable how much demand is. And Howmet does, you know, multiple things, but one of their substantial businesses is making investment cast turbine blades, they ship near final form blades to the OEs, and the OEs you know, machine them and do other special tricks to them, coatings and so on and so forth. But demand for those blades is just super strong, right, both in commercial markets and in defense markets, which I think surprised folks. So given Boeing's manufacturing woes, I think there was a fear that might kind of really impact the business that's most exposed to Boeing. But turns out that was offset by demand coming from other places. So just kind of, you know, in a nutshell, I mean, demand for jet engines, new, used parts, repair, overhaul is just, it couldn't possibly be stronger. So that's kind of where we are.
We're going to go quickly around the horn. But one is, both are sort of optics perception, and I just want to get everybody's take on it. First, Boeing Starliner continues to have challenges, and juxtaposed on that, the Chinese have launched a mission to land on the far side of the moon. They've brought back samples from the Earth-facing side of the moon. The far side of the moon never presents itself to Earth. They're going to land a lander on what is an even rougher terrain and then bring back samples from the far side of the moon. I mean, it's going to be a scientific achievement. And then you have Secretary Kendall's flight, AI-powered flight on the X-62A Vista. Ron, Richard, Sash, what do you guys take away from both of these sort of themes, right? I mean, what do you guys make of both developments?
Yeah, I mean, Starliner, I mean, it's no secret that there's been challenges there. And just, you know, by if you just juxtapose that to SpaceX, SpaceX has been doing better, right? So I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just time to find new contractors for space. Given Boeing's positioning on Starliner, they haven't, you know, said things, at least to the investment community, that are very supportive of it. I don't think they would argue if they got out of that business. So we'll see. You know, ultimately, there's probably other companies that are more capable, more willing, and want to do it. So let them do it. And then on, you know, the Secretary of the Air Force's flight, you know, good for him. You know, just demonstrating, you know, good leadership and, you know, how AI plays out in the military, in the Air Force is, we'll see how that all plays out. But it's definitely going to be a tool that'll have to be understood and used, and you know, that's kind of where we are.
Richard?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's it's hard to not see a competitive threat here from, you know, China and space. You know, this is not commercial jets, where I've got very strong doubts. This is clearly something that's better done at the government level and doesn't depend upon the commercial sensitivities. So is you know, there is this sort of prospect that the Chinese increasingly fill the role that the old Soviet Union does as a sort of impetus to U.S. funding for space exploration and whatever else. Been watching the series For All Mankind about the sort of alternative universe where the Soviet Union gets to the moon first. It kind of reminds me of that. As for Secretary Kendall, wow, good for him. Leadership indeed, and culture, very impressive, you know, and he's not a young man, I gotta say it. Very, very impressive.
Indeed, although I would point out he is exceptionally fit. He's a long-range ocean sailor, among many other things, right? I mean, so he's I think, got a great combination of toughness and, of course, a West Point graduate who knows how to stay shape, as the service academies tend to, you know, inculcate that in you. Sash, you got the last word. You got your hand up before we part.
Yeah, I don't think you need to sit in an airplane to lead, particularly a very, very large, extremely technologically sophisticated air force. It's gesture stuff to me, I'm afraid. I'm sure he's a very, very good Secretary of the Air Force in every other respect, but this leaves me fairly cold. It's worth remembering, and, you know, listeners probably forget, the head of the Royal Air Force is not even a pilot, and he's very, Air Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, he is very, very good indeed and doing a stunning job for the Royal Air Force. You don't need to sit in an aircraft anymore to do this job.
I completely agree with you, and that's not something normally people do, but the fact that he got into an AI-powered airplane, that I think is the key thing. He put his trust in the technology at a time when people are questioning the role of that technology in the future. And if you consider that the next-generation air dominance aircraft is going to be AI-heavy, the fact that the collaborative combat aircraft is going to be AI-heavy, the fact that the air battle management system and some of these other systems are going to be very AI-heavy, I think that that's why it's symbolic. I don't think he's just flying in an airplane to fly in an airplane. And everybody who knows Frank Kendall knows that's not really going to float his boat very much. But I think it was to deliver that message that this technology might be a little bit more mature and something that you may want to put your trust in. And then putting himself on line for that, I think, is important. And we look forward to talking to him about that when next we have the opportunity to do so. And by the way, couldn't agree with you more about Sir Rich. Just one of the most impressive air leaders. And to your point, Sash, right? He's an Air Chief Marshal, and he's the Chief of Air Staff, and he's the head of the world's first independent Air Force. And it sends quite a message that somebody who was behind the scenes, one of the architects of innovation in the RAF, actually then gets promoted to be the head of the RAF. And when he does, nobody even batted an eye that he wasn't a pilot, which I think is very impressive. Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always an honor and pleasure, Richard, especially after the long, long trip. Any last thoughts about your trip to Korea that the audience should part with before we say goodbye?
Well, you know, just what I was saying before about, you know, Embraer being a potential weapons producer for people who like a non-aligned source, I think the same could be said for South Korea, too, as an emerging producer. And also, per what we were saying about Sierra Nevada, companies that aren't so sensitive to immediate investor demands and still have a very large, fraction of engineering leadership, it's pretty impressive to see. And, you know, that's perhaps the biggest competitive threat out there to, legacy defense primes, people who are hungrier, engineering focused, and sending a message of non-alignment. So I was intrigued with what I saw.
And if you look at the growth, which Sash has discussed many times about Hanwha around the world, I think it's very, very impressive in terms of the capability that Korean industry really is increasingly bringing to the fore as there's a thirst for capability, and they make NATO standard weapons. So that makes it easy for everybody.
With KAI, you know, I mean, what's amazing is the two of them are sort of in the right place at the right time. They'd spent decades developing this bandwidth and, you know, with not a whole lot of results, but all of a sudden, demand has absolutely exploded.
No pun intended, but well played, Abulafia. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a terrific what's left of the weekend, a great week, and look forward to having you back on again next week. And to our audience, thanks so very much for joining us. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back again tomorrow with Byron Callan of Capital Alpha Partners, who's going to take a look at the week ahead and discuss whatever else is on his mind. Thanks very much, and we'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.